From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made this past Friday night in the moments before a preseason NFL football game between the San Francisco 49ers and the Green Bay Packers. 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick refused to stand during the playing of the national anthem. After the game, he told reporters, quote, "I am not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color. To me, this is bigger than football, and it would be selfish on my part to look the other way. There are bodies in the street and people getting paid leave and getting away with murder," end quote. Kaepernick's actions sparked immediate feedback and plenty of outrage. He says he will continue to sit down during the anthem. He makes no apologies, and he has answered questions at length about his reasons. Kaepernick says this is not a stand against the American military, which he respects. Some veterans have called on the league or the team to attempt to force Kaepernick to stand. The 49ers released a statement saying they will not do so. Last night in Chicago at a Major League Baseball game, a veteran brought a sign that read, "Veterans sitting with Colin." That veteran is white. So you've got some divisions on this, even in the veterans community. And this hour, our goal is not to replay everything that's happened over the last 4 days, but to focus on what it means for our country. And if possible, we'd like to open some minds, no matter what side you are on here. Let me welcome my guest for the hour. Van White is here. He's a civil rights attorney. You know Van as the president of the Rochester City School Board, but in this context, civil rights attorney representing himself, as always. Nice to talk to you, Van. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, or good afternoon, Evan.
It is good afternoon. Yeah, good afternoon. Yeah. And Chris Thompson's here. Chris is an engineer, an activist, and he publishes his thoughts on the website Chronicles of Nonsense. Nice to have you back, Chris.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
Well, I want to reach out to any listener, no matter where you are on this issue, but in particular, if you are deeply bothered and you don't think he should have really be allowed to do this, feel free to call. And I want you to know this could be a bit of a tough conversation at times, but we're going to try to do so in at least as open-minded a fashion as we can on an issue as volatile as this. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. You can find me on Twitter at Evan Dawson. You can email me edawson@wxxi.org. I have heard some people say that they were initially appalled or they were initially supportive. They've thought about it some more. Their views have sort of evolved over the last few days. Van White, what was the first thing that came to your mind when you heard about this?
Quite honestly, the first thing that came to my mind was Brighton High School.
Brighton High School?
Yeah, the thinking there was when I was in high school, long before I went to law school, long before I probably even thought of becoming a lawyer, our district where I went to high school required, I don't know what the board in Brighton had passed a policy or what the deal was, but they were now requiring that every student stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. Now, I got to tell you, at that particular point, being a proud American, I had stood, you know, almost robotically for the pledge since I was in kindergarten. But the notion that I would be required to stand struck me as ironic in a nation that values the right of free speech. In fact, as you know, the first Bill of Rights is the First Amendment. That's the right to speak your mind. So it struck me even in high school as something ironic, and I refused to stand. And I got a note from the principal. I'd say his name if I was absolutely certain, but I don't want to say his name because it's been many years. And I got a note to come down to the principal's office. And I still have that note. Actually, I went to speak to Brighton High School about 3 months ago, and I showed him that note from the principal. And he said, you know, you're required to stand. And I said, because I'm an American, I'm not required to stand. And it was sort of a standoff, no pun intended. I continued to not stand. And then eventually, when I felt I had made my point, I began to stand again and have stood ever since. So that's what came to my mind, what happened in Brighton High School to me.
But Van, I already see here's a comment from a listener named Joe on Twitter who says, Evan, he has the right to free speech. It's that simple. But here's the difference between Colin Kaepernick and Van White at Brighton High School.
Yep.
The school is part of the government. The 49ers, you know, he can speak freely, but there are consequences when you are employed by a company, by a business, by a team. They may decide this is unbecoming of the conduct that we set, and there may be consequences for you. It's different, I think, to go to a school or a government agency and the government compelling you, you must stand, you must sit, you must say this, you can't say that. That's different when the government tries to do it versus when your employer does, right?
Well, but my understanding is I'm not an expert in the NFL, but the NFL has a rule that you cannot require, teams cannot require the player stand up. So even that private organization has indicated that no one is, and in the finest of American traditions, the NFL has said, you don't have to stand up if you don't want to.
Okay, so before I ask Chris for his thoughts, let me just follow up and then say, you thought of your own experience and what you went through.
Yep.
Seeing what he decided to do, did you have any doubt that this was going to spark a lot of backlash?
For him?
Yeah.
No, not at all. And in that respect, although, as I said, I've stood ever since I did my little protest in Brighton, whether it's at school board meetings or, you know, the district attorney's office, I've always stood. But, you know, anybody with their understanding of history understands that people sometimes pay a consequence for even exercising their First Amendment right, which, again, is sort of ironic that we would say we value the right of people to speak their own mind, but yet we would punish people. But here's the interesting thing. History tells us that people who do that, while by their contemporaries, they're viewed as villains, that later on they become heroes. I mean, I know it's not apples to apples, but it's pretty close. Look at Muhammad Ali. Look at the gentleman during the Olympics who raised their fist with black leather gloves. There's plenty of examples of how we protest our government, going back to the Boston Tea Party. And that those people who are vilified at that time subsequently become heroes. And again, I use as the most recent example. Look at Muhammad Ali. He died a hero. But when it was happening, oh my God, how could he not fight? Again, not apples to apples, but pretty close. Spoke his mind, knew he was going to pay a price, was vilified, and then later history pays him back as a hero.
Is there something inconsistent with just months after the death of Muhammad Ali, in which he has been celebrated, cheered? Is there something inconsistent, Van, with the people who celebrated Muhammad Ali for who he was and what he did, turning around then saying, Colin Kaepernick can't do that? Is that inconsistent?
I think so, and I think time will show the I don't know what kind of quarterback he'll end up being, whether he'll be in the Hall of Fame. But
why is that matter,
Well, let me tell you,
Muhammad Ali, right?
You didn't give me a chance.
Okay.
That's one of the tragedies, that you have to show yourself approved in some other way.
Right.
And time sometimes, I think, is generally. I mean, it doesn't just stop there. Look at Martin Luther King. Malcolm X, the list goes on, and Frederick Douglass, the list goes on and on and on. In different capacities, America tends to, I think, not necessarily because it's intentional, tends to be a little bit more forgiving with time.
But Chris Thompson, here comes the feedback from listeners saying, please don't compare Colin Kaepernick to Muhammad Ali. He's nowhere near as smart and nowhere near as deserving of the same respect. Chris, I know you were sort of railing on this in various forms and places there. Go ahead.
I don't know how smart Colin Kaepernick needs to be, but he was a 4.0 student all through high school, all through college. So, you know, I don't know where the smart metric is. Like, is it street smarts or whatever? But to say that he has no right to say something just because he's not as smart as another person, especially when you're comparing him to Muhammad Ali, who didn't go to college, who was struggling in high school.
Didn't do well in high school.
No, he didn't. Right. Oh, so he didn't do well in high school? So, you know, saying that he's not as smart as Muhammad Ali is a little bit of a false flag for me.
Yeah, and you know, for me, I just, this past weekend, I've been listening to a lot of Malcolm Gladwell, which is a whole other subject. But one of the interesting concepts he brought up in a conversation with Ezra Klein is the idea of earning an opinion. And he invokes the people who bash a book or a movie without seeing it. And saying you haven't earned that opinion, that's not the same as Colin. He's not talking about, you know, nuclear physics, and he's never studied nuclear physics. He's talking about the Black American experience. Mm-hmm. I'd say he hasn't earned that opinion, hasn't he?
He has. And before anybody goes on a tweet storm about how he's got white adoptive parents or his mom's white, he's still considered Black. If he were stopped on the street, or if he was just walking down the street and someone were to describe him, they would describe him as an African-American man. So he has experienced the Black experience, which, again, isn't a monolith experience, but I can see where he's coming from. And whether, you know, you defend what he said or are against what he said, the fact is he has some experience that maybe someone else hasn't had, who's throwing out all the shade at him, saying that he's being unpatriotic or un-American or worst things be shared on
sure,
the air.
Sure, always, man.
You know, first of all, let me just say, and you might have mentioned this, it doesn't make any difference whether he's black or white or somewhere in between. The fact is he's standing up for an issue which is as old as America. I mean, this is that people are upset and uptight about this. Let me tell you something. We would not be the free country that we are unless people understood that they had the right to speak their mind and face the consequences to it. And those were those were by and large white people back then. I'm talking about our founding fathers. They understood that they believed that they had the right to speak their mind, and they therefore had the right and understood that there might be consequences. But this is nothing new, and to act like he's doing something unique or Malcolm X or Muhammad Ali did something. There was a case, as you mentioned, by trade, I'm a lawyer. There's a case in 2009, I think it was, went all the way up to Supreme Court, involved a young lady. I don't know if she was black or white. Her name was Cameron Frazier, and she went to a high school in Florida, Bantan Beach High School. But in any event, she refused to stand for
Boynton Beach.
So you're familiar with this case. She refused to stand for Boynton Beach. She refused to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, and her math teacher said, "You clearly have no respect. You are so ungrateful and so un-American." That's a quote. And then the teacher said in front of the whole class, "Do you know who's out there fighting the wars for us? That flag you refuse to show respect to?" Cameron stood her ground and said, "No." He said, "Our soldiers are out there fighting a war. The flag isn't a piece of cloth. It stands for our country," right? The Supreme Court of the United States in 2009 said, refused to hear that case, which means they didn't think it had merit. The fact is that what Cameron did, what I did, very small potatoes compared to what people have done, the sacrifices people made. But the principle is the same. You have the right not to stand. And the glorious thing about that is, in other countries, you might lose your life if you refuse to stand. Mm-hmm. That's not how we operate. So for all those folks who are getting upset because this young man is not doing what you and I do, what I do. I want you to get starting on me. I'm telling you I stand. But let me tell you something. If I decided not to, I would expect in this country, my brothers and sisters who are black, white, green, blue, would stand behind me because the principle is, in this country, you can do that.
All right, let me grab our first phone call, and our listeners will help guide some of the discussion here. Beth in Brighton. Go ahead, Beth.
Hi, Evan. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Good. I just wanted to bring up Colin's background, and I guess you've already talked about it. I mean, nobody has written anything in the paper about where he came from. You know, his black family, and then adopted by a white family. And I think that's really important for this group to understand. And I'm really sorry that nobody seems to want to talk about that part of his life and how important it was to him to do what he did. But I give you credit, Dan, for what you did at Brighton, and hopefully they'll keep doing exactly that. Okay?
Beth, thanks very much for the phone call. But I would just say, Beth, most of the commentary about Colin Kaepernick's background, as Chris Thompson mentioned, has been used against him to sort of say, well, he's either too rich to comment now, or he grew up too rich to talk about an authentic experience of oppression and struggle, or he's too white, he's not black enough, which is, again, another one of these conversations. But Chris, I've heard all of those things in the last few days, haven't you?
Oh, yeah, I've heard every single angle of this to try to cut him down.
And what's that say to you?
I expected it. Like, as soon as an athlete does something that people don't like, I just wait for them to go straight to the personal. So I kind of expected it. It's a shame. And it just shows that people are not willing to listen to what he's saying, but rather just silence him and just stick with whatever opinion they have. Like, their mind is not open to what he is saying. Like, he's talking about something that's very serious, that's very important to him, that's very important to a lot of people in this country, not just black people, but because it goes against some sort of train of thought where we're saying that the people of authority are just pristine angels, which is not the case because they're human. you know, the institution that he's talking about, he wants it fixed. And people don't want to hear that, so they just go for the personal. That's it. In my opinion, anytime anybody goes for anything that's off the subject of what somebody's talking about, I feel like they actually don't have a legit argument.
Well, on the side of those who feel offended at this, there are those who say he shouldn't be allowed to do it, but there are those, then there are those who say, and we saw, for example, Veterans Outreach Center Chief Todd Baxter say last night, he finds this a tough case to see because he feels it's disrespectful of the flag and disrespectful of veterans, but he's not saying he shouldn't have the right to do it. I mean, Todd, I think, said, look, I'm not at all saying right. he can't do it. I'm just saying it's hurtful to people. It's hurtful to people who've served. So let me hit a couple of things here. Mm-hmm. We'll get Chris and Van's take on this. And again, listeners, if you want to call in no matter where you are on this, 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. John writes to us and says, no disrespect to Mr. Kaepernick, but I don't think he realizes how hurtful this is to me. I'm somebody who served this country, and now my son is serving this country, and I'm not sure he knows just how much this hurts us and our flag. That's from John. Let's listen to another voice on this. This is Sergeant Johnny Joey Jones talking to Fox News from the military. Again, this is not monolithic. I know not everybody in the military backgrounds, everybody has different views on this, but mm-hmm. this is some of what we've been hearing. This is Sergeant Jones talking to Fox News.
That flag and that anthem, that stands for the people that fought the Civil War and united this country. That stands for the people that fought for civil rights and made this country a little bit better. And it stands for the people that are working hard every single day to fix these issues that do exist. Hey, listen, I come from a small town in Georgia. I've seen racism. I've also seen people grow and learn. I've seen ignorance turn into compassion. And you don't do it by drawing more lines in the sand. As a service member, it's offensive for people not to stand for the national anthem. But as an American, it's offensive for you to equate my pride to bigots or oppression or other things that are wrong in this country but will be fixed.
Okay, so Chris Thompson, do you understand the sentiment, the emotion there?
I totally understand it, and you know I respect what he's saying, but has he actually looked at the national anthem? Like, there are four verses of it. In the third verse, there's a line, no refuge could save the hireling and the slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. That speaks to what British people were doing.
Most people don't know that those lines there that you just read.
Chris. Right. So, you know,
we're not singing those words.
No, we don't sing those words. We only sing the first verse at every game. But if you look at the entire anthem, it's a pro-slavery anthem. Like, that third verse is all about killing slaves who tried to escape to defect to the British because they were sick of being slaves. And Francis Scott Key was a slave owner. So I totally respect what that sergeant was saying about, like, this, you know, the spirit of the anthem, the spirit of the flag. But look at what is actually saying. It's actually not for black people at all. It's not for anybody. It's not. It's only for straight white men, honestly.
Do we need a new anthem?
Maybe not a new anthem, but we should at least examine the anthem that we have and acknowledge that there is a serious flaw in it.
All right, let me get Rob in East Rochester on the same kind of subject, because I know Rob is a Vietnam veteran. Is that right, Rob?
Well, hi, Evan. Actually, I'm a veteran of the Vietnam era.
Vietnam era,
and
okay.
Gulf War era. I am a 12-year veteran of the Navy and also the Army, oddly. And I just wanted to say that, you know, my feeling on this is, although I disagree with it, and I always stand when the national anthem comes on, and I'm, you know, proud to be an American, I look at it as the reason that I did that, and part of the reason that, you know, I can, you know, without self-righteousness, was at the tip of the sword, is that anybody can have the right to not stand during the anthem. They can burn the United States flag. It's something that's abhorrent to me. I would never do, and I don't agree with, but that's why we do it. That's why, you know, in my mind, that's why we do that, so people have the right to do those things.
All right, Rob, stay there, because I want to follow up with you. Van, what do you make of that?
Go ahead. You know, I apologize for keeping on my lawyer hat, but you all do know that the Supreme Court of the United States has stood by Kaepernick's decision in a number of cases, including the one that I referenced earlier on, but the more prominent one, I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but it was a case involving flag burning. I mean, clearly an affront to all those that sacrificed their lives for this country in the military. You burning a flag, that's a powerful statement. But there again lies the importance of the Constitution of the United States. In that case, the Supreme Court of the United States, even though this might incite our worst anger about someone doing something like that, it is that very Constitution that requires that we allow that to happen.
All right, I think there's two things here, and I want to ask Rob and Van about this, because I think what we're establishing is, legally, Colin Kaepernick is supported, and the people who are calling for some kind of forcing, as Van White experienced as a high school student, you know, you have to stand for this. You must do this. That is almost certainly not going to happen, and that is against the fabric of this country. Then the second question is this an effective form of protest? Is this a way to heal divisions and affect progress and change? Rob, you know, again, as somebody who wouldn't sit down, wouldn't do what Colin Kaepernick did, but as you say, you feel like you serve for his right to do that, and you respect his right to do that. The second question then for you is, do you see the point he's making, and do you think he has a point to make?
Well, I don't know if it's 100% valid point, but it's one way that we as Americans can raise our voice and call attention to ourselves. And it's, you know, one of the things is it's completely exacerbated and aided by the high speed at which information travels these days. Social media, television network, everybody sees it instantly, and we form an opinion on it. And, you know, one of the great things about this country is you can piss off 51% of the people, you know, all the time. You're not going to make everybody happy, but, you know, as a whole, we have the right to do these things. Is it going to solve the problem? Probably not, but it calls attention to it. It's one man's actions. I don't agree with the action, but I certainly agree with his right to do that.
Evan,
let me just say to Rob, thank you, Rob. Thank you for your service as well. Thank you for calling the program. Go ahead, Van White.
Yeah, there's a quote from Justice Kennedy, one of the more conservative members of the Supreme Court of the United States. The name of the case was Texas versus Johnson. It was 1989. But I just want to read you what Justice Kennedy said. Though symbols often are what we ourselves make of them, the flag is constant in expressing beliefs Americans share, beliefs in law and peace, and that freedom which sustains the human spirit. The case here today forces recognition of the cost to which those beliefs commit us. It is poignant but fundamental that the flag protects those who hold it in contempt. Can't be any clearer than that.
Yeah. Well, okay, enough on that point then. Now let's turn to whether this is an effective way to do it. And you heard Rob Chris Thompson say, he's not sure that this is going to – look, I don't think anybody thinks this is going to solve the problem. The question is this a net positive move in the country toward more recognition, more grappling with our problems? And what I hear from a lot of people who don't like what Kaepernick did is sort of a denial that what he's saying has validity to begin with, which is a separate question of whether he has a right to do it. The question is he complaining about something that needs to be examined more? And I think a lot of people are resisting that. What do you think, Chris?
Another little anecdote from Francis Scott Key.
You laughed a little. Yeah.
Yes. So he was, like I said, he was a slave owner. He was also a district attorney in D.C. And a couple of years after he made the poem that became the anthem, the D.C. police were extremely corrupt. They would take free people's personal items just randomly without any punishment. It finally got to a point where a woman was being robbed by D.C. police, and she fell into the Potomac and drowned. So they buried her. You know, they pulled her out of the river. They buried her. Nothing was said. Abolitionist paper attacked that, saying there's a death and nobody's talking about it. Kind of like the Black Lives Matter movement right now. And Key said that this paper was attacking police, specifically police, not the system, specifically police, making them, vilifying them, making them sound like they're worse than what they are, when that abolitionist paper was basically saying, there's a corrupt system, we need to fix it. So, yeah, I do think that what he did, it's it sparked this outrage. Like, we're on the air right now talking about it, and we're not the only people talking about it. So this, I think, is a good way to bring attention to something, and this is how change starts. Like, it's always messy.
And let me ask you, Chris, and then Van, the same question. Here's one thing I heard from social media. Just about everywhere I turned, I heard mostly white people saying, I don't get why he had to sit for the anthem, which is disrespectful. Why can't he just put his money where his mouth is and do something? You know, that this isn't doing something. This isn't action to them. You know, this is...
How does he know? How do they know he's not?
Well, and that's actually, the funny thing is, when you look into it, he is. He's actually giving to a number of causes. Some of them we already know publicly. That's been well documented. Otherwise, I never assume I know what Chris or Van or Rob or Megan, what they're doing with their money. I try not to assume that. But some people are saying, don't do this. Act in another way.
Right. Yeah, that's another one of those false flags. That would be like, I'm walking down the street at noon on a Wednesday, and somebody says, why doesn't he go get a job? Well, like, well, how do you know I'm not on vacation? You know, like these accusations of him not doing anything but like sitting down are just they're frankly ridiculous. Like, this is one action out of many. This is the one that got the most attention.
Okay.
That's all it is.
Well, Van White, Fox Sports' Clay Travis has said he's complaining about an issue that doesn't really have that much validity. Let me read what Clay Travis said. He says, Kaepernick hasn't even said any specific issues or described tangible decisions made by authority figures that actually oppress black people and other people of color. He says that we've got a black president, the head of the Justice Department is black, and indicates black Americans are not really discriminated against. And then he said, quote, there is no systemic racism in our federal government. In fact, affirmative action is actually a governmental attempt to treat black people unequally, that is, more favorably than other people, solely because of their race. So if anything, the United States government's laws discriminate in favor of black people based on their skin color. End quote. That is Clay Travis of Fox Sports. Van White, civil rights attorney, what do you think about that?
Well, first, let me say to the comment, well, you know, why is he doing this?
Yeah.
Why would he even bother to do this? Well, you know, people ask those same questions. You know, they assume they ask those questions in wake of the Boston Tea Party. Why are they doing that? What's up with that? Wasting tea? You know, that's
can't you find another way?
Well, can't you find another way?
Right.
I'm sure they said the same thing about those brothers, those four brothers from North Carolina A&T, I think it was college they were from, when they sat in the Woolworths lunch counter.
Yep.
My God, can't you figure out another way? This is so disruptive. I'm sure they said the same thing when people were protesting the Vietnam War at Kent State. Oh, wait. You get the point? This is America's tradition, and we are made better as a nation because of the First Amendment. And you can't cherry pick when it's convenient for you, because then it's not the First Amendment. It's Russia or it's some other Middle Eastern country where they get to tell you when you can speak. And to this comment about, well, you know, what's he complaining about? He doesn't even have any facts. Well, the fact is, I'll use one example, and I talk about this in my book that I've reference. I'm not here to push the book, but
that's okay.
One of the examples that I give, and I used to be a prosecutor. You know, I love that job. It was a great experience for me, and I'm proud that I was a prosecutor. But you know, one of the things that you could see in Rochester courts and courts throughout this nation was that African Americans. Let's think about the crack laws, right? They were responsible. They were defendants in 84% of the crack cases in the United States of America. But yet they only counted for 40% of the users, right? So that's an example. I'll give you another example. Why is it that if this is data from the Department of Justice, why is it that if an African American kills another African American, he is less likely to get the death penalty than if he kills a white American, right? Why is it that literally I have made a practice out of suing companies and governmental entities for mistreating people of color if everything is fine? And I'll give you one other example. This is from the Department of Justice, Department of Education. Why is it that black and brown boys are disproportionately, that means out of proportion to their numbers in the population, disproportionately put into special education classes and disproportionately suspended, receiving out-of-school suspension? This is data from the United States Department of Justice and the United States Department of Education. The fact is And the reality is that there are disparities that occur that can only be explained by race. And this data is put before us not by Kaepernick, but by officials in the United States government. So there is a problem. And thankfully, in addition to the First Amendment, we have a constitution that enables us not only the right to sit down in order to stand up. Oh, and by the way, let's not forget the best example of a person who refused to stand up, Rosa Parks. I'm sure somebody said, hey, why are you doing that, right?
You're just slowing down this bus ride.
It's not going to really change anything. What do you think? And it took 300 and something days and a Supreme Court of the United States changed. But the fact is, and I'm the guy who stands up and literally gets chills. I'm right now when somebody sings a national anthem or I'm at a board meeting and I got my hand to my heart. I'm that guy. I am that guy. But I'm that guy because we live in a country where you can say, I'm not going to stand up. I'm not going to get up off this bus. I'm not going to get up off this restaurant counter because this is America and we're unique in that respect.
All right. So listen, I'm way late for a break. We're going to come back. No, it's okay. We're going to come back to your phone calls because we've had lots of them. Jason writes to us and says, Colin Kaepernick is raising awareness in a peaceful way and has directly brought out the ugliness that he is protesting. I think it's perfect. Jason writes that. And here's Tim who writes, Evan, thank your guests for the history lesson on Francis Scott Key. That certainly doesn't get taught in class. There was another one. So Chronicles of Nonsense, if you want to read more from Chris Thompson on that. He's been writing about this. I would also just say to kind of close the loop on Fox Sports' Clay Travis, who is not a law scholar. I would just say if your only understanding of systemic racism or systemic action to benefit one race or another is your view on affirmative action, which is a whole other discussion, but you don't understand the history of systemic racism as it relates to African Americans in this country, then maybe our educational system is failing. Your phone calls as we continue in just a moment. Coming up in our second hour, a new film at the Little Theater aims to tackle all the realities of friendship all the way down to the difficult divisions that come when one friend is more successful than others in a group. The film is Don't Think Twice by comedian Mike Birbiglia. The focus is on not only friendship, but improv comedy. So we'll bring improv into the discussion as well and have some fun next hour on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before I jump back to your phone calls, I'll just say one other note on the question of what Colin Kaepernick's doing and the possible impacts. I referenced Malcolm Gladwell earlier, and one of his podcasts recently was a program he calls Generous Orthodoxy. And the idea is this: if you want to change a system, you've got to be willing to show that you love that system and you want it to change because you want it to be better, and you're willing to give something up to change it. He referenced Chester Wenger, a 98-year-old Mennonite leader who's done work around the world, whose son came out as gay. His son was excommunicated from the Mennonite church, and Wenger decided he was going to leave the Mennonite church, and he did in his 90s. Wow. And now he wrote an open letter about it. It's gone viral. But Gladwell says this is a guy who was willing to give it up to change it, whereas he contrasted that with black students at Princeton who were upset about Woodrow Wilson's name everywhere because of Woodrow Wilson's racist history. But he said they complained, but they said, you owe us everything, we owe you nothing, we're not going to change, we won't sit out a class, we won't sit out a semester. And he said, you know, maybe those didn't, no, listen, we're kind of sidetracking here. But the bottom line is the question of generous orthodoxy and Gladwell's construction. Colin Kaepernick, I don't buy this idea that he's going to get a book deal or he's setting himself up for a lucrative post-football career with this. He could be giving up tens of millions of dollars in endorsement deal and lost football income. And that is part of the generous orthodoxy tradition that Gladwell's talking about. I don't think there's any question, because Van, you said that and to you, that is courageous. Yes?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. Let me get back to the phones. Maggie in Rochester next up. Go ahead, Maggie.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I think that the objection to this is not about, I think it's all about his message. I think that if Colin Kaepernick had been speaking out about an issue other than systemic racism, the backlash that he faced would have been entirely different. I think that there are a million different excuses that people make, such as, you know, we don't like the method that you've chosen, or we think it's disrespectful to the flag. And I come from a military family. My brother and my husband are both veterans. But I think that when the gentleman from Fox News was saying that, you know, it's disrespectful to these things because they're going to get better, this is how they get better.
Right.
And, you know, when Van White was saying that this is part of our great tradition as Americans. I firmly believe that if you have free speech that covers everything except for criticism of the government and of governmental systems, and police are agents of the government, then you don't actually have free speech. Amen. There shouldn't be anything that's off the table. And I think that he took an incredible risk to do these things. It was a nonviolent protest, and there's always going to be someone that says that you shouldn't do what you're doing. But I think what he did was really brave and really right on and deeply patriotic in the ways that we think of, like, the best of our foundational roots. Amen. And I think that if you want to see evidence that there is a need for athletes to use their money and position of influence to do these things, look at the nature of the backlash that this guy is getting, right? Like, he's getting death threats, people, like, using constant racial slurs. Like, this is not just about patriotism. This is about people who don't want these subjects brought up on the national stage, especially football, which has this weird place in sort of the nucleus of, like, white masculinity and the ways that we construct those things, and they don't want those things mixed together, like this conversation about racism. And I think what he did was really admirable. And thanks for letting me finish.
Maggie, thank you. You got nothing but thumbs up from the guests in studio, and a lot of our guests are written in with similar sentiments. But I want to get some callers who feel differently. So let's grab a couple of those, starting with Bill in Rochester. Go ahead, Bill.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Now I don't have a problem with Kaepernick not standing for the national anthem. You know, he has the right to do that. But what I do worry about is that I think that act gives credence to a bogus narrative that the police or justice system creates violence in urban areas. I think this started with the riots in Ferguson, Missouri, and since then violence has surged in urban areas. And I think that's due in part to police being discouraged from engaging in effective activities stop and frisk.
Stop and frisk, which does not have a very successful history, just when you look at the actual numbers. But Bill,
I would challenge that, actually.
Do you have evidence?
It's been pretty successful. In fact, since the time that they've taken that tool away, or they've chosen not to use that tool, you know, how would you explain the bump in urban violence?
Urban violence is not on the rise in this country, Bill.
Have you been actually stopped
and
frisked?
Well, hold on now, just a second.
Urban violence is...
If we look at homicides in Washington, D.C.,
no,
they're up 54%.
Bill, don't pick one city. Don't pick one city.
They're up 73%, and Cleveland, they're up 90%.
Don't pick one city or two cities. You have to...
Well, actually, there were three.
Okay, Bill, in this country... this is an important point. You got to listen to Steven Pinker and the people who have been researching violence in this country. And a lot of liberals don't like hearing this. Gun violence is way down in this country, even though gun ownership is up. Violence itself is way down in this country. Now, there's a couple of cities that if you look at a shorter time frame, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, violence is up for various reasons. But when it comes to violence in this country, violence is significantly down. Violence against police officers is down.
That's correct. However, we're talking about urban areas.
Yes, and violence in urban areas is down. Violence against police officers is down in this country almost across the board. You can find a few cities that are outliers, but most of the statistics show that violence is going down.
Well, how about Baltimore or Chicago?
Oh, well, I'm from Baltimore. I can tell you about Baltimore myself.
In Milwaukee and Cleveland.
All right, so hold on a second. Chris, Bill, why don't you stay there? Because, again, I think this is important, and I'm not at all trying to sort of stamp out a viewer. I'm just trying to make we're kind of framing this accurately. Chris Thompson?
And let alone Philadelphia is another one you can throw in the mix.
All right, Chris Thompson, go ahead.
So I grew up in Baltimore. Well, starting from high school, I grew up in Baltimore. So I've been stopped and frisked before it was actually called stopped and frisked. I was going to school. I was going playing ball with my friends. I wasn't doing anything wrong, but I would get stopped regularly just going to school. And you can't tell me that they were doing this because I looked like someone. Because just last week, a 10-year-old was stopped, guns pointed at him. He was almost got shot because the police were looking for somebody who had dreadlocks. This kid did not have dreadlocks. He was 10 years old. They were looking for a 20-year-old. So stop and frisk, you can say that it works. It works by just like bludgeoning something. It's like using bleach on a pencil mark on a table. It wipes out everything, including my rights. Now, in Baltimore specifically, what I suspected that I was getting stopped just because I was a black kid who looked like I could have been up to something based on my dress. This has been shown by the DOJ that this is a rampant problem. Now, the report just came out this year, but this has been going on for years. Years in Baltimore City. Yes, we had a crack epidemic. Yes, we did have a high crime rate, but the crime rate's gone down. And the mayors, all of the mayors of the last like 20 years are not getting enough appreciation for that. I'm talking about Kurt Schmoke. I'm talking about O'Malley. Even I forgot the one who I moved right when she got into office. And even Rawlings Blake. Like all these people have done strides to get the police to a point.
So let me ask you, do you believe stop and frisk then is an ineffective policy which has actually increased violence in urban areas?
No, it hasn't increased violence in urban areas. Okay. The violence that happens in urban areas, it will happen amongst the criminals of the urban areas. The basic citizens is what stop and frisk affects.
Let me just jump in for 1 second. And Bill, I want you to stay there only because Van White literally has to get out the door a few minutes early because you are an attorney who's practicing.
Gotta go to court.
Okay, yeah. So I want some quick thoughts from you and then I'm coming back to stop and frisk. But go ahead, Van.
Well, you know, as you said, and I would ask the caller to look at the Department of Justice. Whenever I give statistics, I know it can be debated depending on who the research is coming from. But I would encourage you to go to the Department of Justice website. Their website is really readily accessible. And the trends are down. They're down. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Yeah, I wouldn't challenge that.
Okay. And then let me also say, having been a prosecutor, assistant district attorney for 4 years. And prior to that, while I was in law school, I had to work my way through law school. I worked at the crown jewel of U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia. I worked in the misdemeanor witness room. And my job was to coordinate witness appearances and evidence for the people, the local district attorney, which was the U.S. Attorney's Office. I did that for 4 years. So my whole 8 years of my professional career as a lawyer was spent working as part of the prosecution team. And let me tell you this. And then let me just tell you, and I'm not trying to put my credentials out there. After right. that, I spent 4 years working for Mayor Johnson as sort of an anti-crime position. And even there, I was working hand-in-hand, not with defense lawyers, but with police officers and chiefs of police and all those folks that keep our community safe. You know what I think makes a big difference? It's not the broken windows theory, although I'm not averse to that. That was used in New York City. We use some of that here. What really impacted crime, I believe, is this, and I think we've actually gotten away from it, community policing, an approach that engaged community members in the reduction in crime. And reduction meant this. It meant intervention, getting involved in young people's lives through education, through mm-hmm. Other activities, prevention, and interdiction. So it's a comprehensive response to crime and violence. You not only put away the guys, it's about 10% of the population out there is committing 90% of the crimes. That's also Department of Justice stat. But it also is about engaging the community in an anti-violence effort. And so you do that through late night basketball. And we were doing that aggressively in the 90s and in 2000s. Mm-hmm. It's bolstering your educational effort. So my point here is I think too much credit, and I was there. So you can't say I'm sort of this dispassionate researcher. I was there when it come to the broken windows theory. And, of course, I was there when we started talking about a comprehensive response to crime and violence. And what works is community policing. What works is getting the entire community engaged, not just the police.
All right, you got to go. Get out of here, Van White. Van White's a civil rights attorney. Thank you for being here.
Thanks,
and I know you got to get a couple minutes early. Bill, I want to follow up and just read one thing to you because I recalled reading this and I just pulled it up on my phone here. This is an editorial 3 weeks ago. The newspaper that was probably the loudest in opposing the ending of stop and frisk in New York City was the New York Daily News. And the New York mm-hmm. Daily News published an editorial 3 weeks ago titled, "We Were Wrong." I want to read from their editorial. Quote, "Make no mistake, This is what the New York Daily News wrote. Our editorial commenting on the judge's ruling 3 years ago said the following. Make no mistake, the judges put New York directly in harm's way with a ruling that threatens to push the city back toward the ravages of lawlessness and bloodshed, end quote. In other pieces, we predicted a rising body count from an increase in murders. We are delighted to now say that we were wrong. The New York Police Department began scaling back stops under Commissioner Kelly before the judge's decision and accelerated the trend under Commissioner Bill Bratton. As a result, the number of stops reported by cops fell 97% from a high of 685,700 stops in 2011 to just 22,900 in 2015. But then, not only did crime fail to rise, New York crime has hit record lows. The murder count stood at 536 in 2010, at 352 last year, and it sure seems to drop further this year. There were 1,471 shooting incidents in 2010 under stop and frisk. By 2015, shootings had dropped to 1,130. The downward march has continued this year, a marked contrast to crime spikes in some major American cities. Explaining crime trends is extraordinarily difficult. However, we can now say there can be little doubt that NYPD's increasing reliance on so-called precision policing or stop and frisk did not work. That's from the New York Daily News. What do you make of that?
Well, obviously, there, like you mentioned, there are lots of tools that are used by police to try to better control crime. But at the same time, you know, I guess we can compare data. But what I see in front of me is that there's been an increase in violence in urban areas. Now, I wouldn't disagree that stop and frisk is the only tool available to police, and obviously it's caused a lot of controversy in urban areas, so maybe they've got to develop another tool. But what I do worry about, I think the narrative which suggests that police engagement in urban areas is a result of has resulted in increased violence. I just think it's a bogus narrative, and I don't think it's going to do anything to help better control hostilities in urban areas.
All right, Bill, I've got to jump in and say, first of all, thanks for the phone call and thanks for engaging on this one. I think this is where we're going to start to wrap it up here because we're going to be out of time in a minute. But Chris Thompson, I think Bill's phone call indicates that part of what Colin Kaepernick is doing is trying to expose this gulf in just the way we look at policing. He talked about policing in his statements. And I'm not trying to knock Bill down because this caller is concerned about American cities. He wants the best for American cities. Mm-hmm. What I'm simply saying is I'm an evidence guy. And when you have the New York Daily News saying, wow, look at the numbers. Stop and frisk not only didn't work, it unfairly targeted African Americans with deleterious effects beyond just whether you're reducing violence. We've got to at least be, I think, evidence-based. And I'm trying to find a way to kind of, how do we kind of bridge some of that divide?
Well, it's not a matter of lack of police engagement. Lack of police engagement will make crime rise, but more police engagement might make crime rise. The thing is, how do the police engage in the community? So, like what you were talking about, community centers, with police talking to community leaders, that's how crime goes down. That's how crime has been going down. The police have been more cooperative with these communities. When the police go into a community and act like they are, you know, they're adversaries and have this aggressive stance to everyone, that's when crime goes up because they don't want to talk to police because they don't trust them. And this has been going on, obviously, since like 1812.
All right, so in our last 30 seconds then, Chris, you can read more of his work online at Chronicles of Nonsense. He's an engineer, an activist, a writer, comedian, many other things. What do you think is going to come out of the Kaepernick issue? Is this going to move it forward or backward here?
It's going to move it forward. No matter what anybody says, it's going to move it forward. He's stirred the pot. He sat down for his rights at this point. And we're talking about it right now. We'll finally get to, you know, maybe 10 years from now, we will actually see what happens.
Yeah, I think you and Van make some important points, though, this hour to say, for those who say, why does he have to do this? Can't he just do something? This is doing, you know, and we may not look back at Colin Kaepernick as Rosa Parks or Muhammad Ali, but But it doesn't mean this isn't action, I think, is part of the point here. And I want to thank you for being here. It's always nice having the conversation with you. Wish we had two or three more hours. To Bill, our caller, I'm going to try to spend some time digging on numbers in other cities. I mean, what we know is the evidence says stop and frisk did not work in New York City at all. But I'm going to try to at least be open-minded to what's going on in other cities. I hope we're all open-minded and we can continue these conversations going forward. Short break, more connections next.